Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Saragon. Sara, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. How's it, Nick?
Very good. And Mr. Marius Rutt, Marius, how are you doing?
How's Nick? How's Sara?
Right, let us not dilly-dally and get into the news of today. And I think the interesting story of today, and it's at least so far not been really well covered, maybe that's because it's quite a new news story, but there was a joint press conference between the IFP and DA in KZN, where the chairperson of the DA in KZN, Dean McPherson, was meeting with the IFP's provincial leadership there. And they were talking about ways that they were planning to cooperate in undermining the ANC's control of the province. And I think the most interesting of those various things they announced is a sort of alliance that's going to be done in Ward 99 of eThekwini, so in the city of Durban. The ANC is only holding on in the city of Durban by, I think, about 9 seats, and that was partly through the managing to win over many small parties in a very, very sort of messy coalition environment there. But in Ward 99, previously, the DA got about, I think it was about 20% of the vote. The IFP got about 30% of the vote, and the ANC was the biggest party winning the rest. I may be slightly off there, but that's kind of the gist of it. The three parties are quite close to each other, but well, the ANC is the biggest.
The ANC got 30% of the vote in that ward.
So 30% of the vote, so even less.
They were the single biggest party, though, so that obviously that's why they won the ward. So.
Right. So the DA said that in order to try and wrestle control of the city from the ANC and reduce their very narrow margin there, they are going to back the IFP in that ward and, in fact, not run a candidate. Now, this is not the first time we've seen this in our election politics. I think recently in the Western Cape this happened, and the Freedom Front Plus, I believe, also in a municipality has done this as well, where they decided not to run a candidate. So what we're really seeing here is, I think, some really fascinating examples of the way that despite all the noise, the fury, the frustration, the madness that you get from looking at the headlines, the skills of managing coalitions are beginning to emerge across the country. And that I think is really fascinating here. Marius, what are your thoughts? Do you think this has a chance to knock off the ANC in that ward? And could this be the beginning of a much broader form of cooperation that we might see across the country?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's something we need. We've obviously, at the Institute on the Daily Friend, been talking about the wild dogs thesis where, you know, parties, DA, IFP, actually say Freedom Front Plus and whatever, you come together to bring down the ANC and the EFF also to a degree. So I think this is part of this coalescing around a kind of a broader anti-ANC front. But it's also complicated. We've seen the IFP has also voted with the ANC occasionally, especially up in Joburg. And the IFP has also works with the EFF in quite a few KwaZulu-Natal municipalities. So I think that also complicates any kind of alliance it has with the DA. But let's also, some people will also remember there was a kind of an informal alliance or coalition between the DA and the IFP in 2004. And it was called the Coalition of Change then. But apparently DA insiders these days talk about the Coalition of Chaos, because it was such a mess, and it didn't seem that the DA or the IFP actually benefited much from, you know, kind of working together in that election. So, but also, that said, provincial and national elections are different from ward by-elections, so there is something different there. But as you also point out, this is part of a growing trend. It was in the Cedarburg, where the last time this happened, where the Freedom Front Plus and a local political party called the Cedarburg First Residents Association, in a by-election, they both decided not to stand candidates and encouraged their supporters to vote for the DA. And the DA candidate did win in the end. It was actually quite a close-run thing. The DA candidate got less than 50% of the votes, but the opposition votes were split between the ANC and the Patriotic Alliance, which meant that the DA candidate won. But if there hadn't been, if there'd been other kind of, if the Freedom Front Plus and the local party had run, perhaps the DA wouldn't have won. They managed to win that seat. So overall, I think this is a positive development for opposition politics in South Africa. And as you said, I think it shows that parties are starting to learn about coalition management and so on. And I think this is all just part of South Africa's democratic kind of maturation. I think we're kind of in a different transitional period now. We're moving away from this dominant party system where the ANC has dominated South African politics such a large degree for the last 30 years. We're moving to a time now where the ANC is just one of, you know, a whole bunch of parties which could be in power. The ANC is probably still going to be the biggest single party in South Africa for a while to come yet. But it's definitely not going to be this, you know, juggernaut or colossus that, you know, kind of strides across the country. And I think that's what we're seeing now. And yeah, I think it's, you know, I think we're in quite an interesting period for South African politics. I think interesting as in just normal interesting, and interesting in the Chinese sense of the word.
Definitely. I think, yeah, there's you can really see a future where the parties actually will draw up agreements beforehand when it comes to ward elections to say, okay, if you don't run in these wards, we'll run in these wards, whoever has the best chance of winning some of these wards. And through that, create more stable, more robust coalitions with maybe more seats. And there was a wonderful example of this actually in Israel, which has a threshold for its parliament where one of the party leaders had to go and campaign for a different political party who he had managed to win over most of the support from. But he was worried that they would drop below the threshold. So he went to try and convince some of the people he had just convinced to vote for him to not actually still vote for that whole party. And I think this really does show that our parties are getting into that. That is what I would call a coalition mindset, where you look towards saying, okay, we've got a very complicated, diverse political system here. We've got a lot of different voices represented. How do we negotiate our way through to come together around some things we can agree on to make a government that's workable? Sara, what do you make of this?
I think it's interesting because it's tactical, it's strategic. It's not a sort of done on the whim of some guy who fell out of bed in this morning and bumped his head or did something ridiculous. It actually has a purpose. And if you can get agreement on it, you've also developing that sense that the responsibility of both parties have certain responsibilities as a result. That doesn't guarantee that they'll behave properly in future. But the stakes here are high, and you know, at some point it should actually twig for all the parties who get into an arrangement like this for coalition purposes, that although you may have to sort of swap a favor, you actually, people will hold you responsible for the decisions you've made. And if you backtrack or do something completely idiotic, it may come back to bite you. So there is a certain amount of honor amongst, I don't want to say thieves, but honor amongst thieves. And they will take if they feel it strategically makes sense, they will take their supporters with them. You know, as I say, no absolute guarantees, but the stakes here are high, and so I think this sort of tactical decision making can only be pluses for the opposition as a general concept.
Right, and one of I think the important things to kind of note here is that this doesn't mean that you suddenly have to form a permanent structure together and go into bed with each other, right? So at the same time this agreement was happening, there's news stories on the same page on the website about the DA, and in fact, literally the same person, in this case, their provincial chair, Dean McPherson, attacking the IFP and Freedom Front Plus for the actions of a mayor in which the DA and Freedom Front Plus are part of a coalition there to keep the IFP in control. So clearly, I think one of the keys to running these things successfully is managing to separate the sort of tactical maneuvers from the rhetoric, which is that, you know, you can still believe what you believe, you can still preach what you preach, but you also at the same time have to be able to make a deal when important things are on the line. Morris, any final thoughts?
Yeah, just two things. I just want to point out that the reason there has to be a by-election in Etegwini is because the ward councillor was killed by two policemen. Because having looked before this, I'm not too sure, it's not too clear why the man was killed. And I don't know if it was because of ANC internal fighting or some other reason, but just, you know, policemen killed at politicians. It's crazy. I mean, in lots of other countries, it'd be, you know, on the front pages, even if it was just a town councillor, you know. So, but just then on the issue of coalitions, one thing that coalitions do need is also to have some kind of broad ideological thread that holds them together.
And at least some objectives together, right, that are beyond but just even then, being in power.
Yeah, because, that was what happened in Israel. There was a very broad coalition that got rid of Benjamin Netanyahu. But it was, you know, people, it was liberals, it was centrists, it was even some right-wingers, plus some Arab leftists. And the only reason that they were together was to get rid of Netanyahu. Once they got rid of Netanyahu, then the thing fell apart. And I think the same thing might, it's a warning for South African opposition parties, because a lot of them are going to work together just to get rid of the ANC. And once you got rid of the ANC, then you actually have to govern. And if you don't have any kind of thread holding it together, apart from getting rid of the ANC, then it becomes very difficult. Mm-hmm. So I just think that's something that our opposition parties need to think about. And, you know, the DA and the EFF working together, is it possible? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so look, I think one of the there's going to be a lot more focus on actual policy questions rather than all the nonsense of talk about personalities and teams and all that that we currently have, which is, you know, if there is a anti-ANC government, will they do something like get rid of BE? Those are going to be the important questions that that coalition is going to have to answer, because some parties like the DA are going to say yes, and some parties might even say no in that coalition. But I'm thinking particularly some of the very small breakaway, you know, the sort of ABCs and things, all these weird parties that have one seat. So that's something I think everyone needs to think about, and there needs to be more discussion about actual policies that people can coalesce around when it comes to coalitions. Anyway, let's move on to our next story. And there is a lot of action in the headlines today because the man who murdered former Communist Party leader Chris Hani has been released on parole, or has been ordered by the Constitutional Court to be released on parole. Judge Raymond Zondo, in a unanimous decision of the Constitutional Court, said that the government had not acted correctly when it had denied parole to Janusz Wals, who murdered Chris Hani in, what is it, 1992, I believe?
93.
It was, yeah, the same year I was born.
Weekend, 1993.
Yes. Now, anyone who was alive then will remember that everyone was afraid that this would be the beginning of some kind of great civil war in South Africa. Thankfully, nothing like that happened. But it was a very tense time, and so it's understandable that people are very twitchy about this subject. But Zondo said that denying him parole was not in accordance with the law. He said that the murderer had a low chance of reoffending and that he had apologized to Hani's family more than once. Zondo said the minister's decision is not rationally connected to the purpose of the power conferred upon him. His decision is therefore irrational and fails to be reviewed, and it fails to be reviewed and set aside. In the circumstances, I am of the view that it is just and equitable that the court should order the minister to place the applicant on parole. The Vals was originally sentenced to death, but had his sentence commuted and turned into a life sentence. And after 13 years and 4 months of his life sentence, he was allowed to qualify for parole, but the Justice Department has blocked that until now, in large part because of the insistence of Chris Hani's widow, who has very much not wanted to see him released from prison. Zondo went on to say, and I think this is possibly the most interesting part of his judgment, they drafted, talking of Chris Hani and some of the other people at that time, they drafted a Bill of Rights that conferred fundamental rights on everyone, including those who supported apartheid with all their hearts. Indeed, they drafted a Bill of Rights which conferred fundamental rights upon even visitors to our country, so that upon entry into our country, they began enjoying the benefits and protections of our Bill of Rights. There was a lot of upsetness about this. The South African Communist Party's General Secretary said this was a very disappointing judgment for that. For us, we believe that in the Court of Justice, an injustice has occurred, an injustice against our people. Panyaza Lesufi said that we feel betrayed and let down. And Chris Hani's widow said this judgment has opened the court has not even addressed the victims. I don't exist, she's referring to herself. He, Zondo, is busy giving us a lecture about how a Polish man who came to SA to kill my husband. Do you understand how I feel? Zondo has failed this country completely, and I'm not going to apologize. This country is finished. In this country, a foreign white can come into South Africa and kill my husband. He, Zondo, couldn't give a shit. He couldn't be bothered, said Hani's widow. Sara, what do you make of this court case? In your sense, was it the right move to release him on parole?
I think, I think it was the right thing to do. I could understand him not being released as a result of earlier applications, and because obviously the whether he's apologetic, I have problems with apologies, but whether he's apologetic or the feelings of the family were taken into account, and I'm sure that had a very big impact on whether he was released at an earlier stage. But a point is reached. What would it be now? About nearly 30 years since the crime was committed, where what comes from most of the comments, the negative comments made, is a sense that these are not constitutionalists. These are not people who actually care that the Constitution is supreme and it covers everybody, good or bad. And with all due respect, I mean, the severity of the crime and the potential consequences could well have played a role, but nearly 30 years later, those should have diminished, as well as obviously his own behavior. His widow has never accepted an apology from Valush. So it doesn't matter what he says, she was never going to accept it. And the intemperateness of her language is. And look, I don't want to sort of say what should have happened. He wasn't my husband. I didn't have that experience. But when you think of the high levels of murder in this country and the extent to which people or families of victims largely have to kind of put up with the inadequacies of the justice system or live with the fact that people ultimately are on parole, you get the feeling, particularly in the comments from people like Le Soufi and like the SACP, is that somehow Hani deserved to be his death deserved to be dealt with much more differently to everybody else's. And that is worrying because you then have, you know, what's good for thee is not good for me. And I found that very disturbing. And the language, referring to it as diabolical, etc. Wow, that's just very, very unpleasant.
Right, to say that the country is finished, as though a license has been granted to simply murder people at will, which is clearly not what's happened here. And, you know, I must say, I'm not a huge fan of, you know, you committing a very cold-blooded murder and then getting parole after 13 years in my personal capacity. I don't think that's really fair, but those are the rules. And I agree that, you know, we have a constitutional order and it says certain things and it says that everyone is entitled to these rules, to these protections and these rights.
Can I just say with regard to that is that you get the right, say he got the right to apply for parole after 13 years. So there was a right prior to that. There was no right prior to that. And you might say the right was granted too soon, but the parole wasn't granted too soon. Factors were taken into account that I think at the time most of us would have understood and agreed with, but that was over half a sentence ago. And, you know, there's a point at which you don't have to forgive and you don't have to forget, but the law says X, and the factors were taken into account that warranted his granting of parole.
Maurice, your thoughts on this? You also saw an interesting comment on this from lawyer Richard Spoor, and one-time guest of the Daily Fringe as well.
Yeah, so Richard Spoor made the point that if there's no possibility of parole, then it also means that a prisoner is not going to even try to rehabilitate themselves or behave well. If they know that they are going to be locked up in prison for the rest of their lives, there's absolutely no incentive to try to become a better person and so on. And I think we have to decide, is South Africa a country of laws or is it a country of men? And it's a country of laws. And Janusz Walusz has paid his debt back to society. Of course, he committed a horrible crime. And the reason for his crime was he wanted to plunge South Africa into a race war. That was part of the motive behind the murder. Also, he was virulent anti-communist, having grown up in communist Poland and so on. But still, that doesn't excuse, you can't go around killing people that you disagree with politically. So Janusz Walusz, I think he should have been released, and he spent 30 years in prison, and in the South African prison, which I don't think, you know, I don't think they're pleasant places, not like at your local Aventura resort. It's probably not a nice place to really hang out at. And let's also not forget, he's been stripped of his South African citizenship, which means he's probably going to be deported back to Poland as soon as he's out. And that means going back to a country he probably hasn't been back to for 40 years, which has also changed, you know, a lot. I mean, he left when it was still a communist country. It's going to be a very different place. And he's probably destitute, so, you know, he hasn't worked for 30 years or whatever the case is. I don't know if he's got any family or anybody to help him in Poland. So the poor man's not, you know, things aren't looking too good for him. And, you know, he's an old man now, and I think, yeah, let him out. He's paid his debt back to society. If he's not going to reoffend, and he's not going to be South Africa's problem anymore, he's probably going to get sent back to Poland, as I said. So, but yeah, I mean, I do think the way that a lot of this people have reacted to this is disgraceful. And the fact of the matter is, if he was being kept in prison because of who he killed and not what he did, he's actually, in a way, becoming a political prisoner. So I think this is definitely the right decision made by Judge Zondo. And good for Judge Zondo, who's made quite a brave decision, I think, and decided, look, these are what the rules say. This guy's fulfilled everything. He obviously did something, I would imagine, probably Raymond Zondo is an ANC sympathizer, probably didn't like what happened to Khazali. But he decided, look, this is, I mean, the guy's done everything he needs to do. He's ticked every box. He's got to be released, you know. And so good for Judge Zondo. And, yeah, I mean, that is what it is.
Yeah, I must say I've been very impressed with a lot of the stuff Judge Zondo has done. His criticism of VEE and the Zondo Commission report, his some of the brave stances he's taken. I'm not sure I'd agree with him on everything if we sat down and had supper together, but I think that this standing up for the Bill of Rights and taking a very unpopular but correct decision is brave of him. So hats off to him. Sara, any final thoughts?
Just to say, is to remember that this was a unanimous decision. So he made the decision, but the decision was the court's in every sense of the word.
Exactly. And that's a point I wanted to make was, this has been reported as Zondo let him off. But no, this was a unanimous decision. The constitutional court said this.
And the other thing is in there, there are two linked things here. The one is that despite the heinousness of the crime, he is probably not exactly at risk of offending again. And look, we've turned political assassinations into an art form in this country. I mean, KZN et al. So, times they have changed and things change with them. And, I think that's where it should be left.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I understand a difficult case, but probably the right choice in this case from the Constitutional Court. Okay, let's go overseas now to talk about a country which, on first glance, doesn't have a lot of similarities with us, that is Malaysia. But when you kind of look past beyond the superficial, you actually begin to see quite a lot of things that Malaysia perhaps has to teach us about South Africa. So Malaysia has just had its a very contentious election, and it is, for the first time, it has no party is able to form a government. It has a hung parliament for the first time in its history. And the party which surged to do really well in this election was the hardline Islamist party, which believes that Malaysia should be run by under Sharia law. And they are looking to form a coalition with the sort of Malaysian-centric conservative party there in Malaysia. At the same time, though, it looks like the alternative, which is a coalition of parties that are generally a little bit more moderate, look like they are still going to have the numbers to form a government, even though none of them did as well as the Islamist party, which I believe is now the biggest party in their parliament. I think they have something like 40 seats out of the 222 seats in the Malaysian parliament. So there's our first similarity with South Africa, is a contentious election, lots of turmoil in the country, and a coalition needing to be formed to keep out parties that are not super keen on sort of democracy and human liberty. But at the same time, Malaysia is also one of those countries that has remarkably similar affirmative action laws to South Africa. Malaysians for a long time have felt that they have been economically discriminated against in favor of Chinese and Indian Malaysians, and therefore there were lots of laws put in place in Malaysia to ensure that Malaysians would be prioritized when it came to appointments to various jobs and economic opportunities in the country. That does not seem to have worked, though. Indian and Chinese Malaysians are still, in many ways, much more economically successful than Malaysian Malaysians or Malay Malaysians. And there is at least some people in Malaysia now who think that it's well past time to get rid of these affirmative action laws, which, much like in South Africa, haven't made that big of a difference, I think, to many people. Marius, what do you make of this? Have I left something out? What's your take on this election?
Yeah, I think I agree with you. It's the first time that Malaysia is going to have a hung parliament. And this all comes that they've actually had a bit of a political crisis over the last 2 or 3 years. They've had 4 prime ministers in 4 years. They've also been having some economic issues, high inflation, lots of a hangover because of COVID-19 and the various lockdowns and so on. And I think it also shows the rise of the populists. It's not just in places like Europe, and I suppose you could argue as well with the EFF and so on. We've seen this political party, as you mentioned, its name escapes me. It's something like the, pro-Malaysian Islamic Party or something like that. But yeah, it's the single biggest party with 20% of the vote. So there's definitely something to look out for. Malaysia is also quite a diverse country. And obviously everybody should be able to practice their religion in any way that they want. But I think it does become a problem when there's a political party that wants to implement something like Sharia law across the country and turn Malaysia into an Islamic state. As I say, it's quite a diverse place, and obviously there are a lot of non-Muslims that live there. So it does become a bit of a problem if just one religion wants to be force them to people who aren't members of that religion. So it's definitely something for South Africa to, I think we need to look at what's happening in Malaysia. It's, we're going to start seeing what's happening. The what's happening there is probably going to be happening in South Africa one of these days, where we have hung parliaments, you know, lots of infighting between political parties and so on. So I think it's a bit of a glimpse into the South African future, what's happening in Malaysia. And yeah, it's definitely something to look at. But just something quite interesting. Just had a look at the GDP of Malaysia and South Africa. And South Africa's GDP is just slightly higher than Malaysia's. But we've actually got quite a similar growth trajectory. We've actually grown sometimes a little quicker than Malaysia. At times has been, they've been growing a bit quicker than us, but it's actually remarkably similar. And as I was saying, there's quite a few similarities between Malaysia and South Africa, especially with the issue of affirmative action. Also quite a diverse place with you know, lots of different ethnic groups trying to work, you know, get along in one country.
Right, and it's not like it's a country with an overwhelming majority of one religious group here either. It's, I believe it's about 64% Muslim and about 19% Buddhist and about 10% Christian, roughly speaking. So, yeah, you can imagine they are not destined for good times if they decide to embrace a very hardline Islamist approach there in terms of social stability. But anyway, Sarah, what do you make of the story? What do you think it has to teach us as South Africans?
I think it has to teach us that nothing is indefinite. Power, you know, something as powerful, the equivalent of something as powerful as the ANC. Time may change, but nothing's guaranteed. Times do change, and strange parties become bedfellows often in a bid to change or to change a dominant party or to keep a potentially dominant party out. So in very many respects, what's interesting about Malaysia is the fact that it is has so many similarities to South Africa. So it's not a question of comparing them to a Western paradigm or a very poor third world paradigm. It's that range of paradigms in between that make it particularly interesting. I certainly don't think amongst the religious groupings they include there's a Jewish population, because the Malaysian prime ministers have been notoriously anti-Semitic. So I don't know if there's any future economic ties on the offing, in the offing with Israel, but you know, times they do change, so maybe they'll do it.
I just looked it up now, and this is going to make everybody's hair stand on end. So in 1990, South Africa's GDP per capita was $7,000 per person. Malaysia's was $6,800 per person. So, you know, basically the same. Yep. Today, South Africa's GDP per capita is $14,000 per person. So it's about doubled. Malaysia's is nearly $30,000
per person.
So Malaysia's gone up about nearly five times. South Africa's only doubled. So it tells you the big differences between South Africa.
Exactly. They're paying attention to the economics more.
Yeah.
And if you want an idea of how, so yeah, despite that though, they have probably worse human rights than us. The guy who may become the new prime minister, Anwar Ibrahim, who's probably going to lead the sort of more moderate coalition, was previously charged with the crime of sodomy and almost was imprisoned for it for a time. Which, you know, in South Africa is, you can't even imagine, despite some of the targeting of gay people that goes on here. I still can't imagine that happening. Just before we go into our next story, I want to thank very much Real Dude Vision and Lawrence Garrett for your donations to us. That's really appreciated. And thanks, guys.
Those are the real names.
Very, very kind of you. Right, so last story today. Wits University has long had a planetarium. But apparently the university has received a 75 million rand donation to transform the 62-year-old planetarium into an upgraded digital dome. I believe the planetarium closed to the public a couple of years ago. My memory is a bit hazy on that one. But the idea is to revamp it with the 75 million rand donation and use it as a place to promote scientific research, artificial intelligence, and digital arts, contributing towards the city's aspirations of becoming a smart African city within the next 2 years. Well, I don't know about that second part, but I like the first part. the plan is to have the new dome, the newly revamped dome, open to the public by 2024. The project is being funded by Anglo-American. Sarah, your thoughts?
I hope that part of the upgrade includes the dome, the inside ceiling of the dome, which, they, you know, when back in the day when I was a youth, you used to go to the planetarium and you sit in the seat. I think you could lean back, and the night sky would be replicated in the dome, and it was kind of magical. So when I heard it had closed, I thought, you know, this was a sign of South Africa's this sort of disintegration. But if they, times having changed to the extent they have, if they can still provide that wonder to the public and provide a space for digital work, for filmmaking, etc., I think it'd be a great use of the planetarium. It also, if it pretty much retains the shape, if not the entire structure, it was very symbolic of Wits, and it was very much a Joburg institution. And promoting science and astronomy at the same time, I think that'd be great.
Maurice, any thoughts before we close up?
No, just great that it's getting revamped. I remember when I was also a youngster, some really interesting times at the planetarium. I was learning about space and all that, and so it freaked me out a bit, but I think I've always been quite interested in space, and I think planetarium probably helped boost that interest.
Yeah, absolutely.
100%. All right, that's all the time we have for today, so thank you very much, everyone, and we will see you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day.